We're ready to hear the Salmons case. Parties are ready. And again, I think I may have seen you signing in, but if you haven't, if the council would please sign in. And of course, you have 15 minutes each. Do you wish to reserve any rebuttal time?
No.
Very good, thank you. We're ready.
Good morning, my name is Dave Davis. I represent Mr. Salmons in this appeal. And I believe that both sides approach it the same way, that there's it boils down to the motion of the defendant to sever two counts at trial. The judge chose not to do so, and the appeal concerns his failure to do so. And I believe that we're discussing Rule 386B, and then in addition to that, whether justice would require the separation of trials beyond whether there was a scheme or plan that would put it under 386B.
If we find that it violates 386B, we don't reach the 3A10 question,
no,
correct?
That's correct. I believe that I'm going to start kind of that portion of the report. I believe that the failure of the judge to sever these trials is really evident from the way the trial proceeded, and near the end of the trial, where the jury was deadlocked, where they were not able to come to an immediate decision, and there was a 5-7 vote, and we don't know which count that was. But part of my argument is that is the example of what happens, of how my client, Mr. Salmons, was prejudiced because these two counts were tried together. And a reading of this case would show that, and I would admit that one count was very much stronger than another count as far as the evidence.
But definitionally, the trial judge has to make that the decision to sever or not sever without that piece of information.
Correct.
So while it may go to whether any error might have been harmless, it can't answer the question as to whether severance was required or not.
Yes, sir. I agree. As stated, the part about whether it is a common scheme or plan, there was much argument about that in a pretrial motion and in, I guess, the briefs that have been filed before this court. And certainly there are some similarities, but the position of the defendant is that those few similarities are not enough to cause this to be such a common scheme or plan, or as the Commonwealth has now filed, connected, to make it appropriate to
hear these. Excuse me. Our standard on that is an abuse of discretion, is that right?
Well, the abuse of discretion, though, it's not a yes, we're saying it abuse of discretion in the court, and the trial judge, as you know, has discretion after reviewing 386B. So it's not total discretion, and I believe that some judges may think of that, but in this case, there were two young children that knew each other. As I've stated, the one case with the one child was had a lot more detail, had a lot more testimony, a lot more facts and factors that went into her testimony, and she was a fairly good witness. The other count, I would say, just the opposite. There was hardly any factors that the alleged victim could testify to about exactly what happened. And she was not so good of a witness. is. And this brings me to my point of whether justice would require separate trials. In the briefs and in argument before the trial court, I was concerned and still am concerned about the availability of some of the evidence coming from one case into another. I argue that it wouldn't be admissible, that the evidence in one count wouldn't be admissible in the count of another. And I know there are exceptions to that rule, but I would argue that that would have had to have been determined in those trials. In other words, if there would have been separate trials, if the Commonwealth sought to produce evidence from the alleged victim of the other count into that trial, there would have been argument about whether that particular evidence would be admissible or would not be admissible. So our contention is that most of it, if not all of it, would not have been admissible. So that's basically our argument. It's very simple and straightforward. And I'm going to be sure that way on my opinion. So.
Questions?
Thank you for listening.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I please the court? I'm Elizabeth Kiernan on behalf of the Commonwealth. As counsel has noted, the issue before the court today is whether these two cases were properly joined for trial, whether the trial court failed to sever them. And we're looking at whether justice required separate trials and whether there was a common scheme or plan. In this case, there was a common scheme, and the offenses were also connected. This was the same type of injury to the same type of victim.
Ms. Kiernan, under common scheme,
yes,
and most recently commented on by the Supreme Court in Walker, at least in the footnote that talks about common scheme, it's not enough that they're similar. They have to be so idiosyncratic as to almost suggest a criminal signature. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, so in Walker was predominantly focused on a common plan.
But there's the footnote.
Yes, and so a common scheme is where you have, again, as Your Honor noted, idiosyncratic features that permit the inference that the acts were accomplished by the same person as a pattern of criminal activity. They don't have to be so idiosyncratic as to constitute a signature. And in this case, the crimes were similar enough to permit the inference that they were part of a pattern of activity by the same individual. It's a reasonable inference to infer that the same person committed both crimes when two girls were molested in the same way, with the same age, in the same trailer, within a two-month period.
Well, on brief, you list a series of similarities.
Yes, sir.
But I have questions of whether any of them are truly idiosyncratic similarities. For instance, you begin with the both victims were 8 years old. Well, the charge was a violation of 18.2, 67.3A1, aggravated sexual battery of a victim under the age of 13. It would seem to me that every victim of that crime would be under the age of 13, and therefore that 8 being one of the ages under 13, that's not particularly idiosyncratic. Was there any evidence that he targeted 8-year-olds because they were 8, that he had any proclivity for 8-year-olds, anything like that?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that the evidence that was that he targeted 8-year-olds, because both of these girls weren't just under 13, they were specifically 8 years old, and they were also present in his house.
Right. But if one of them had been 9 instead of 8, would that destroy your argument?
No, Your Honor, because we're looking at, I believe we're looking at these as a whole, and again, as the court has mentioned, we're looking at an abuse of discretion standard. One individual difference isn't going to defeat this analysis. The cases where the courts found a common scheme, like in Scott, for example, those victims were entirely dissimilar. They were different genders, they were different ages, they lived in different places around the city. There wasn't such a similarity as we had in this case. Again, the code section does require it to be a minor, but these minors were extremely similar. They were girls already known to him, already present in his house, and they were 8 years old at the time.
Well, I mean, doesn't that go to opportunity as much as idiosyncrasy?
My position is that it would go to both, Your Honor.
And you list that they're both female. I'm just struck that it would not be idiosyncratic for a male person accused of aggravated sexual battery to prey on females. That doesn't strike me as idiosyncratic.
It may have just been minors, Your Honor. It could have been a pattern where minor children that were boys or girls were molested. In the Foster case, there was a young boy, and then there were additionally young girls. And it's a different analysis in that case. However, the fact that there could have been different victims, I don't think takes away from the point that these victims were very similar. And it wasn't just the victim, it was also the timing, it was also the place.
Another factor you rely on is that he told them not to tell.
Yes, Your Honor.
Have you ever heard of a sex crime where the perpetrator told the victim to tell? I mean, that seems to me that would be standard in every single one of these.
Well, again, in both of these cases, they were young girls. They were the defendant was in a position of supervisory authority. He hurt them during the commission of the offense, and then having hurt them, he said, if you do this again, I'm going to hurt you again, presumably. And so I think they are similar. And if you look at the body, so we're saying they were both eight. Maybe that doesn't make them idiosyncratic. But when you look at all things together, they were all so much the same.
Well, I want to go back to my question. Can you imagine a circumstance where a crime is committed against somebody 13 and older and they tell them to tell as opposed to not tell?
I haven't seen one in my research, Your Honor. However, I don't think that defeats the analysis that they were threatened without a gun, you know, it wasn't a violent case. Again, I think these are similar in that way.
Well, I mean, the case with the rock in the park, I think we can all agree that as a weapon of choice, the rock was unusual, arguably idiosyncratic. Don't tell doesn't strike me as at all idiosyncratic. In fact, what would be idiosyncratic is if he didn't say that.
Sure, Your Honor. And it's worth noting that Yodley was decided under the theory of connectedness. Which we've also argued on brief that these two cases could have been tried together under a theory of connectedness. Yodley was cited to the trial court. I believe the record has a typo. It looks like it's spelled with a U instead of a Y where the Commonwealth is talking about it, but they do again talk about the rock situation. And in that case, those two crimes were not exactly the same. They were just similar in the means of time, place, and manner of commission. They're both in the park, they're both in the work day, and you threaten them with the rock. They weren't exactly in the same place, though. One victim was in his car, one victim was on the park bench. The violence was escalated in the second offense, just as the assault was escalated in this offense. But again, like Yellerly, we do have the similarity in the time, place, and manner of commission. And the Commonwealth could have found that these crimes were properly joined under that circumstance as well.
Well, and another factor on brief that you argue is, for lack of a better term, idiosyncratic, is isolation. It strikes me that most aggravated sexual batteries do not occur in a crowd.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, I would argue that the similarities across the totality of those circumstances are not what makes them idiosyncratic. Each individual factor considered alone, as Your Honor is pointing out, I'm sure that many domestic violence, many of these assaults occur in isolation. However, when you have all of those same factors across the board unilaterally the same type of assault, the same type of threats, the same house, the same age girls, I think all those factors together are strikingly similar, and under the common scheme analysis, they show a pattern of criminal activity and a pattern from which you could infer that the same person perpetrated all of those offenses.
Counsel, let me interrupt you again, if I may. Would the analysis differ? The common scheme cases generally are when questions of identity are before the court. In this case, there's no real question of identity. The question is, did he do it? Does that make any difference at all?
I think it would be a clearer case, Your Honor, if identity was more prominently questioned in the record. However, the defendant said that this didn't happen, that he didn't do it, he doesn't know, you know, how they're coming up with this. And so the defendant could have pursued a theory if someone else did these crimes. He had no explanation. Counsel chose in closing argument to argue that it was a dream or something on behalf of one of the girls, but where he was denying all responsibility, the fact finder certainly could have inferred that another person committed this crime rather than the defendant. So I think under those circumstances, it would be relevant to prove identity, and a common scheme does come into play in other circumstances other than those identity cases. The court noted in Scott that it was just drawing on those inferences from the modus operandi cases to come up with the definition. So I think while it borrows heavily from those cases, it doesn't need to necessarily be tied to cases of identity.
Although it was decided under common plan.
Pardon me, Your Honor.
Although Walker was a common plan case, although they do have language about common scheme in it.
Yes, sir.
Would you have preferred to have this argument before Walker was decided?
Yes, Your Honor. however, I don't think there's a specific line at the very end of Walker where the Supreme Court says the Court of Appeals decided this issue based on a common plan, and that's all we're looking at. They don't go into common scheme. They don't go into connected. And I would argue that this court has a basis to affirm on any ground that's apparent in the record, and especially on the connectedness theory here. We have a case that was cited to the trial court. We easily could have found that these cases were connected, and that is distinguishable from Walker, in which the court was only considering the limited common plan. And for the reasons in Walker, we don't have a common plan here, but that wasn't what the trial court found. And so for those reasons, I would say that it's distinguishable, but yes, it does. I wouldn't have preferred to have this argument before Walker. And the final issue before the court is whether justice required separate trials in this case. And the defendant's argument in this regard is that one case was not as strong as the other. And that is not the test in these cases. The test is whether evidence of one would have been admissible and evidence of the other. And I think on this record, we can say that that is true. Victim's testimony can be, or the other victim's testimony could have been admitted as proof of knowledge, as proof of intent. The jury was instructed that the defendant had to have been acting with the intent to sexually molest, arouse, or gratify, and the repeated instances with these children certainly shows that his intent was to sexually gratify himself, so it would have been for that reason. Further, it goes to explain why the victims came forward when they did. We heard testimony in this case that they got together, they realized they'd both been molested by the same man, and so to the extent that this crime was reported 8 years after it happened, both the victims' testimony would have been admissible to prove why they're moving forward at this time.
Do you agree that we don't reach the justice question if we decide there was an error on 386B?
No, Your Honor, because if the defendant's substantial rights weren't violated, then this court can go ahead and consider in a harmless error analysis type way. The court did that in Foster. It's Rule 382 that says any error, defect, irregularity, or variance in the application of a rule does not constitute reversible error unless the substantive rights of a party have been affected. And then went on to consider whether the evidence would have been admissible in one trial or the other in a harmless error type analysis.
Bringing up your favorite case again, though, in Walker, when they found the violation of 386, they didn't reach the 3A10.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, I'm not aware if that argument was made to the court in that case. And again, I would say that I believe that same approach was in Satcher, which was possibly a Virginia Supreme Court case. But I think the Virginia Supreme Court case law on reaching harmless error is clear. Again, Perry is a recent Supreme Court case where we talk about affirming on any basis in the record. There's no additional fact finding necessary for these type of conclusions, and whether the court elected to reach it in Walker, I would say doesn't impact this court's ability to go that route if it were so inclined. Again, I don't think we need to get there because I think at minimum we have connectedness and we have that the justice didn't require separate trials, but if the court disagrees with me, I would ask the court to affirm on that harmless error basis.
Thank you. Any additional questions?
Nothing.
Thank you. We'll come down and recounsel. Thank you.